Hello, this is episode number 12 of Mrs. Endicott's Splendid Adventure by Rhys Bowen. Your reader is Chris Knapp. Episode 12. All seemed to be getting better by the day. The Allies had landed in Normandy the previous June and pushed up through Italy. The south coast of France returned to its previous peaceful state. But all was not well. Further attempts to send Tommy a package through the Red Cross were not successful. And then the news trickled through. The occupants of that camp in the Vosges had been moved to a camp in Eastern Europe as the Allies approached, a camp called Auschwitz. It was much later that they found that Tommy had not survived the transport there. Clive gave a great wail of anguish. I think I knew all the time that I'd never see him again. Oh, my poor, sweet, kind Tommy. How could they do this to him? I'm so sorry, dearest Clive. Ellie attempted to hug him, but he pushed her away. Where will I go? He asked. What will I do? He looked around him. I can't stay here. There is nothing for me now. In spite of Ellie's entreaties, he went back to the house he had shared with Tommy. He wanted to be in the place where they had been happy together. Ellie urged him to take his goat and some chickens with him, but he refused. You can't give up now, Clive, Ellie said. Not when we've endured so much. Tommy wouldn't have wanted you to. Keep painting. You have great talent. Paint a memorial to a brave man whom I loved, too. He held her then, and they cried in each other's arms. He did take the cat Manu with him, and Tiger walked around the house complaining bitterly. After Tommy's death was confirmed, Ellie and Nico waited a while before they were married. It's not the right moment, she said. We are in mourning for a wonderful man. Such a brave man. I will treasure him forever. I agree, Nico said, but I have grown tired of my mother making me go to confession because we are sharing a sinful bed. Ellie looked at him tenderly. After what the world has just been through, do you think the fact that we love each other counts as sin? Of course not. But you know my mother. Old school Catholic. Confession every time you have an impure thought. I bet you had to go to confession a lot when you were younger then, she teased. He wrapped his arms around her. I love you so much, he said. I never believed I could be happy again, and now I am. So am I, she said. All right, then. I'll marry you as soon as you want. But shouldn't we wait until the war is officially over? I know the end is in sight, and the Germans are gone from here, but we have to remember that there are still people in camps, as Tommy was, still waiting to be liberated, and so many people displaced from their homes. Nico nodded, considering this. You're right. We'll get married, but should only be a small ceremony, as we are still in mourning for Mr. Tommy, and Hitler has not yet surrendered. She went down to tell Mavis the news and ask if she and Luis would stand as witnesses for them. Mavis looked at her in disbelief. A small ceremony with just two witnesses? Are you barmy? What we all need now is a chance to celebrate something. Look how many people in the village have lost a relative or friend. We should learn to be happy again. She broke off. I've been happy. I've got the best man you could want. And now you have too, even though I thought he was a pirate to start with. Ellie laughed. So you think we should have a proper wedding then? Invite everybody? Mavis nodded. I do. But shouldn't we wait until the Germans have surrendered and the war is officially over? Who knows how long that will take? They are stubborn and proud, those Germans. They might keep fighting even though they can't win. I say let's be happy now, she frowned. Too bad there won't be any fabric in the stores. I'd like to make you a wedding dress. We can raid Jeanette's wardrobe again, she said. My mother-in-law, she thought, toying with the words and the ridiculousness of this. Maybe one day she'd tell Mavis. Righty-o then, Mavis said. Let's come up and have a look. They went through the ball gowns and Mavis decided on a pale blue silk. There's enough in that skirt to make you a simple dress, she said. They are wearing everything short these days, aren't they? Help yourself to anything you can use for yourself, Ellie said. Me? I've got my own wedding outfit that I haven't had a chance to wear since, Mavis said. The invitations went out, the dress was made, and Ellie and Nico were married in a simple ceremony. Somehow enough wine was found for everyone, and Madame Blanchette managed to make a cake, although she complained about the lack of butter and eggs. As the toasts were raised, Nico stood up. I would like everyone to raise your glass to a brave man who gave his life for my wife and me, to Mr. Tommy. Glasses were raised to Mr. Tommy. The words echoed in the clear air. Clive brushed away a tear. Ellie knew how hard it must have been for him to attend any celebration, and that he had only come because of his fondness for her. "I'm so glad to see you happy at last," Mavis said. "Who'd have thought, when we set off all those years ago, that we'd find the place where we belonged, right here?" The Germans surrendered. The war was officially over, and Saint-Benet held a party. The street was decorated with bunting and balloons and flowers. Flags flew from all the boats in the harbor. A band played. People hugged each other. Then, as everyone sat at long tables, Monsieur Danton called for silence and got up to speak. "I was about to raise a toast to the citizens of Saint-Benet for their courage and endurance and the part they played in defeating the enemy, but I have received a communication from the new government asking us to name and shame those who collaborated with the enemy." "Madame Adams," one of the women stood up, pointing a finger at her. "She was one. She was friendly with those Germans." "They were forced upon me," Mrs. Adams spat out the words, her face bright red. "I had no choice. I was told to house and feed them. What could I do? A woman alone with no man to protect her?" "Yes, and you didn't do badly from it, did you?" the woman snapped. "We could smell the coffee and the meat that you cooked for them." "So they gave me coffee and meat to cook for them," Mrs. Adams retorted. "I couldn't refuse to cook it, could I? They would have shot me." "My brothers and sisters, calm yourselves." Father Andre stepped in front of them, raising his hands. "I think we must agree that Madame Adams had no choice in the matter. We all saw how the soldiers threw their weight around, how they robbed us of all our foodstuffs and tools. And this poor woman had to survive alone, with her husband gone and presumably dead. She did what she could to survive, as we all did. Now is the time for forgiveness, as our Lord would want us to forgive." "But what about Giselle Blanchette?" one of the young men shouted out. "She collaborated. She went with German soldiers." Giselle screamed as hands grabbed her and dragged her forwards to stand in front of Monsieur Danton. "Here she is, the slut, the whore. What should we do with her, hang her from the flagpole?" voices echoed around the square. "No," Giselle screamed, "it wasn't like that. I really loved Wolfgang. He was a nice person. He didn't want to fight. He wanted to marry me." Monsieur Danton hesitated. "This girl doesn't deserve to die," he said. "She's a sinner, if there ever was one, Father. She needs to be punished, taught a lesson," someone shouted from the crowd. Then a woman screeched, "Shave her head. Let the world see her for the traitor and whore she is." And in spite of Father Andre's pleas, someone rushed away and returned with clippers. Madame Blanchette shouted in protest. Giselle struggled as they attempted to hold her down. Ellie glanced at Nico and nudged him. "Make them stop," she said. Nico stood up, roaring. "Enough! Stop this nonsense!" He stepped out, grabbing a man by the collar, and jerked him away from the girl. "We are civilized people. We will not behave as our oppressors behaved. You should be ashamed of yourselves." "She's a young girl who was attracted to a young man. What is so wrong with that? There was only one traitor in Saint-Benet, and that was the Viscount, who betrayed us and is responsible for the death of our beloved Mr. Tommy. He better not show his face here again, or I will be the first to press charges, or to strangle him with my bare hands." "The Viscount," the words echoed around the square. "And now, enough drama," Nico shouted. "Let us get on with celebrating." There were cheers, and glasses were raised in a toast. Madame Blanchette came over to Ellie and Nico. "I can't thank you enough for saving my daughter," she said. "I warned her, I tried to talk to her, but she wouldn't listen. She was flattered that a German boy liked her. Now let us hope she will settle down and get some sense into her head." The party went on until the first streaks of dawn appeared in the sky. "Now, perhaps, we can finally go back to enjoying life," Nico said as they walked home. Visitors started to return, as did Mr. Adams. He had spent the war in Gibraltar, having been taken from Corsica to the coast of Spain and then making his way south. But he said he had not suffered as they had. Life in the British enclave had not been unpleasant. There were plays in Gilbert and Sullivan. bangers and mash and English beer. Mrs. Adams did not seem overly pleased to see him back, especially as this was a new and confident Mr. Adams, who was clearly going to be the boss. Ellie thought about Mrs. Adams. She had never warmed to her or really understood her from the first day they had met. The sort of woman who was a survivor, she realized. She did not consider right and wrong, just what was best for her at a particular moment. Ellie realized how easily Mrs. Adams could have turned them in if they hadn't helped her own husband. The Viscount did not return. A little later, they learned that the chateau had been sold to a film director. There was excitement about this and the hope of seeing movie stars in Saint-Benet. As soon as postal contact had been restored with England, Ellie wrote to Lionel asking about their sons. She wrote a brief factual note saying that she had survived the war and life was returning to normal. A brief and personal letter arrived back saying that Richard was still stationed out in the Far East but was well and had been promoted to major. Colin had been demobbed from the RAF and returned to his bank. Here were the latest addresses for both of them. Before Ellie could write to her sons, she received a letter from each of them. Richard hoped she was well and looked forward to visiting when he returned from the Far East. Colin wrote a longer letter. He had survived flying 4 years of Spitfires before being put on to training new recruits. He had also met a young lady and hoped to bring her out to meet his mother when travel was reestablished. She's from a good family, you'll be pleased to know. Her father is a vicar, so quite holy, and she was jolly brave in the WRAF. Ellie treasured the letter, looking forward to a future wedding, grandchildren, hope for the future. Thinking of grandchildren made Ellie's thoughts turn to Jojo. Recently, the little girl hadn't plagued Ellie's dreams so often, with so many other worries, but now she felt she had to know. She talked to Nico about it. Do you think we have any way of finding out whether she's all right? I'd worried about her so much. I suppose we can make inquiries, he said, although everything is still so chaotic that I doubt records are up to date. What was the mother's name? Yvette, Ellie started to say, then shook her head. It's probably useless. I don't even think she gave us her real name. All I know is that the man she was with was called Ali, and he was a bad lot. Someone in the police somewhere in France will know about him. Someone somewhere in France, and he's called Ali. That gives me a lot to go on, Nico said with a wry smile. Ellie sighed. I know, it's hopeless, but I'd just like to know Jojo is safe and well. We'll do our best, Nico said, but she is with her mother. And not all mothers are perfect, as I can attest, but the mother has her rights. I know, Ellie said. I just want to know, that's all. They spoke to the police in Marseille, but they were not helpful, saying, if you don't know a last name, really we have no chance. And we have so many missing persons to trace right now. Then, when Ellie had given up hope, she received a letter. Dear Madame Ellie, I'm sure you are surprised to hear from me, but I felt I had to write to you. It took a long while for me to realize how very kind you were to me, how you took me in, a complete stranger, and believed in me when I was lying to you all the time and using you for my own ends. Now I feel so bad. When you met me, I was not running away from home. I was fleeing from the police. They rounded up our gang, but I managed to escape. I saw your face at that garage, and you looked kind. Without your help, I don't know what would have happened to me. I would have had my baby in prison, and she would have been taken from me. So you saved both of us. It has taken me all this time to see what a fool I was. I met Pierre. He was handsome and he flashed money around. I was from a poor home with a dismal future ahead and was immediately seduced by him. When I found out that he was in a group of bad men, it was too late. Ali came for me to make sure I did not talk to the police or give anyone away. He was very evil. At last the police caught up with him and he is now in jail for many years. So I had a chance to take Jojo and go to an aunt, where we live today. Jojo is a lovely little girl, so pretty, so clever. You would be so proud of her. And I am working hard to give her a good life. I said once that you were an angel, and it's true, you were. 1,000 thanks. You are Jean-Marie, not Yvette. Chapter 45. Nico started fishing again. He told Ellie he wasn't good at doing nothing and missed the sea. He also bought a new speedboat, expecting the return of summer visitors, and demonstrated it to Ellie. What do you think? Better than the last one? Do you think we could go over to the island? She asked. I wonder if the abbot is back there yet. Don't you think he would have written to us? I do hope he survived and regained his strength. At least the monks will know, Nico said. He turned the boat toward the island, and they sped forward. As they came up the steps, a monk threw down his gardening rake and hurried towards them. What do you want here? He called. No visitors, except on the first Sunday of the month. We've come to see the abbot, Ellie said. Abbot Gerard. The monk shook his head. It is now Abbot Bernard, he said. What happened to your last abbot? Nico asked. We heard he almost died and was very sick. Abbot Bernard will know more. Was Abbot Gerard a relative? A dear friend, Ellie said. Ah, I see. Please follow me. He hadn't gone far when they saw a large man striding towards them. He had a round, bald head and an impressive paunch under his black habit. What is this, Brother Matthew? Who are these people? Visitors asking about Abbot Gerard, Father Abbot. The big man reached them, staring at them with such dislike that Ellie shrank closer to Nico. We are good friends of Abbot Gerard, she said. My husband and Abbot Gerard were part of a team that transported Jewish men to safety. Nicholas and the abbot were both shot and left for dead, but Nicholas managed to bring them both to shore in Corsica, as I'm sure you've heard. I did hear and do not approve. His reckless acts put the whole abbey at risk, he said. Ellie wanted to say that his acts saved some good men, and she was sure Jesus would have approved, but she swallowed back the words. Do you know where he is now? Ellie asked. We should like to write to him. When I last heard, he had been transported to the mother house. They will know. Now it is almost time for Compline. I bid you good day. Show these people back to their boat, brother, and please do not disturb our peace again. I hope the monks appreciate what they have now, Nico said, as he helped Ellie back into the boat. Ellie looked back at the island as they sped away. She would now never need to go there again. They returned home, and Ellie wrote to the mother house. She received a reply almost immediately. My dear Ellie, I can't tell you what a joy it was to receive your letter, and to know that you and Nico are well and happy. He talked of you so frequently when we lay in hospital. I could see how fond he was of you. I too thought of you often and prayed for you daily. I finally recovered enough to return to my order, although not to my former position. It is thought that I would lack the stamina to run the show, as they say. Instead, they want me to stay on here as librarian, a quiet and peaceful existence, until one day I am back to full strength. However, that is not what I want. I have shut myself away from the world for long enough. I began to see when I lay in the hospital that I had been called to the priesthood, not to make liqueurs and minister to pious young men, but to make the world a better place. So at the end of the month, I am leaving the order and volunteering as a priest at a refugee camp in Germany. It's in a former concentration camp. Other volunteers are already planting flowers and trees, painting the buildings to make it a welcoming place for those who have nowhere to go. I hope you might visit us sometime. I will continue to pray for you both. Your friend, Gerard. Ellie held the letter to her and fought back tears. You cared about him, didn't you? Nico asked. Very much. I always thought he was the sort of man I'd like to have married. Gentle, studious, good sense of humor. Instead, you married a loud fisherman, Nico laughed. And I have no regrets, she said. Mr. Tommy was finally honored in a ceremony in Marseille, along with Nico and the other freedom fighters, and posthumously given a Croix de Guerre by the French government. The ceremony was held on a brisk and breezy day in March on the waterfront. A bell was rung as each name was called and flowers were placed on the memorial. Clive went up to lay flowers for Tommy, a proud, defiant look on his face. He told Ellie he had started painting again, big, dark, swirling canvases that were getting a lot of attention. One of his canvases was chosen to be hung in the newly renovated cathedral. After the ceremony, at which he received Tommy's medals, he moved away to join an artist colony down the coast. I'll miss you, he said as he hugged Ellie. You've been a sister to me, but I have to be brave enough to start a new life. Ellie hugged him, promising to come and visit soon. Madame Barbeau had gone down to the village to visit friends. and Ellie was alone in the house one day when she was alerted by a motor horn. She went outside to see the gate being opened and a taxi there. The driver poked his head out the window. "Visitor for Villa Gloriosa," he said. "This is it?" "It is," Ellie waited. A man got out of the taxi. He was bald, with sagging cheeks, and walking with a stooping gait. "Lionel?" Ellie called out as she recognized him. "What a surprise! What are you doing here? You hate abroad, remember?" "I came to see how you were, if you were all right," he said, and looked around him. "I was concerned about you, Ellie." "I'm doing very well, thank you," Ellie replied, watching him walk towards her. He looked around. "Colin said you lived in an impressive house, and you certainly do." "Come inside," she said. "Are you planning to stay nearby or just passing through?" "I'm not sure yet," he said. "I took the train to Marseille. Horrible place, dirty, full of foreigners." Ellie tried not to smile. They reached the villa, and she opened the door for him to enter the foyer. "I must say you're looking awfully well, Ellie," he said. "Obviously you had it much better than we did in England, bombed night and day." "I hardly think the Germans would have wanted their bombs on Surrey," Ellie said. "Well, not as bad as London, obviously, but the occasional one felt not too far away. And rationing, of course. We still rationed, you know. Tiny portion of meat for a week. Haven't seen a banana in years. Can't get my decent scotch. It's been hell. But I suppose you were nicely out of it down here." "We had our share," she said. She installed him in the sitting room and went to make a glass of fresh lemonade. When she came back, she found him out on the terrace looking out across the bay. "This view is magnificent. How can you afford to rent something like this? Your monthly allowance wasn't that big." "No, it wasn't," she said. "Luckily, I don't need to pay rent anymore because I own it." "How can that be?" he asked. "Did you sell the London flat?" "I didn't need to," she said. "I just heard from my solicitor in England, and the rent has been accumulating nicely during the war years. I'm going to use it to buy a couple of properties here. There would be more need for tourism now." "Ellie," he said the word firmly, making her stop and look at him, "are you really happy here in this place with these people? How can you want to live among foreigners?" He took a deep breath. "Ellie, I really came to bring you home. I want you back. I miss you. It's never been the same since you went away. Nothing was ever right." "What about Michelle?" she asked. "There is no more Michelle," he said. "She got bored with me quite quickly, I think. Anyway, she met a Yank, and she's gone off to America with him. It never really worked. She was useless as a housekeeper, didn't know how to cook properly, lots of foreign muck, like spaghetti. The place was a mess, and I was always in a bad mood because I could never find anything. I realize now that I made a big mistake in marrying her. I suppose I was flattered that such a bright young thing could be interested in me." "There was supposed to be a baby," Ellie said. "Ah, yes, the baby. She made a mistake. She was never very regular," she said, "so she jumped to conclusions." "She jumped at the chance to marry someone rich, Lionel," Ellie replied. "Anyway, it was a mistake, and I let you down. I don't think I can forgive myself. So what do you say, Ellie? Shall we give it another chance? You could keep on this place for summer holidays if you like. I wouldn't mind if you went away for a month." Ellie gave him a sweet smile. "I'm sorry, Lionel, but I like it here. I'm happy here. And besides, I'm already married."
"You married a Frenchman?"
"I did," she said. "This is his villa, then?"
"It is."
"Ah, so he's an aristocrat, not a local person." "He's both. He's the son of a duke, but was raised by a fisherman. His father is dead, but his mother lives here with us. And before you ask, we are very happy." She looked up as she heard steps coming up from the dock. "Ah, here he is now." Nico emerged from the steps onto the terrace. His hair was windswept. He was wearing old blue denims, and he was carrying a large rag. "Look what I caught," he called out. "We'll be feasting tonight." He stopped when he saw the visitor. "This is my former husband," she said in French, then added in English, "Lionel, I'd like you to meet Nicolas Barbeau, my husband." Nico went to shake hands, then realized he was still holding a fish. "How do you do?" he said in English. "Welcome to our home." "Well, thank you," Lionel replied in a clipped voice. "Nice place you have here." "That is because my wife made it beautiful like this," Nico replied, giving Ellie a beaming smile.
She made this house into what you see.
I did, Ellie agreed. It was a ruin when I took it over. It's been a labor of love.
You always had the knack of making a place look beautiful, Lionel said. Our home always looked just perfect.
So will you stay the night, Lionel? Ellie asked. I can make up a bed for you in the guest room.
No, thank you, he replied stiffly. I should be getting back then.
Oh, I let that taxi go. Do you have a way of calling another?
We can drive you into Marseille, Ellie said. Or better still, Nico can take you in the speedboat. It's a lovely ride.
She switched to French, in case he hadn't understood.
He nodded, d'accord.
Well, that's jolly kind of you, Lionel said.
Are you sure you don't want to stay in the village? Ellie asked. There's a nice little pension run by English people, and the bar cooks good food.
Presumably laden with garlic, Lionel said.
No, I think I'll be going back then. It was foolish of me to come. I should have realized an attractive woman like you would be snapped up. My mistake. I'll be regretting it for the rest of my life.
Look, at least stay and have a meal with us, Ellie said.
Lunch on the terrace. I'll make sure there's no garlic.
No, I ought to go. Too painful, he said. I suppose it's gradually dawning on me what lies ahead. It was bad enough during the war, but now that Michelle has gone, I'm rattling around to that big house. You can't get household help for the love of money. Nobody wants that sort of job since the war. I eat in the club most of the time, but I'm 62. Going to retire soon. And then what? What on earth will I do with myself?
I've got a nice little flat in Knightsbridge, Ellie said. If my tenant moves out, you can use that. It's only one bedroom, but you won't be entertaining much, will you? And it's quite convenient for Harrods.
She saw him wince as he remembered the wording he had used for her, and immediately felt bad.
Come on, Lionel. I'll walk with you down to the boat. Nico has a lovely new speedboat at our dock.
He followed her gingerly down the steps to the harbor below. The new boat bobbed at its mooring, its polished teak gleaming in the sunlight. Nico helped him climb in.
Are you coming too? Lionel asked.
No, I think I'll leave you men to it, Ellie said.
Why don't you take him instead? Nico asked her in French, pausing on the quayside, giving her a knowing grin. Show him how well it handles.
All right. Ellie returned the smile, accepted the challenge, and climbed aboard.
Lionel looked at her, then at Nico on the dock, as the latter started to unwind the ropes.
Your husband is not coming?
No, he thinks it's better that I drive you.
You? You know how to handle a speedboat like this? Are you sure? Are you qualified to do it?
Oh, yes, Lionel, she replied. You'd be amazed at the things I can do now, so hold on tight.
She steered the boat away from the mooring into open sea, then she pulled back to full throttle.
The boat surged forward with a roar, flinging Lionel against his seat.
Ellie allowed herself a big smile.
Epilogue. Ellie and Mavis sat together on the terrace outside the Villa Gloriosa. It was the anniversary of Dora's death, and Ellie had opened a bottle of champagne to toast her.
I never thought I'd take to her, Mavis said. Bossy old cow back in England, wasn't she?
She softened up a lot when she got here, and she knew we cared about her, Ellie replied.
She certainly did. She loved every minute of it here, didn't she?
Remember how she went swimming? She was fearless.
She paused. Unlike me, I've never learned to like the water.
Luckily, Luis doesn't either.
She looked at Ellie.
I'd say we've done quite well for ourselves, wouldn't you?
Who would have thought when we set out in Lionel's Bentley all those years ago that we'd find a whole new life here, good men and happiness?
I know, Ellie said. Sometimes I still can't quite believe it myself.
We dared to take the first step, Mavis, and that's why it worked out for us. How easy it would have been to retreat to a dismal cottage in England and feel sorry for ourselves for the rest of our lives. Instead, we've had a great adventure.
We certainly have, Mavis agreed.
Ellie put champagne and handed Mavis a glass.
To Dora, she said.
Mavis raised her glass. And to us.
Author's note. Saint-Benet is a fictional town, but anyone who knows the south coast of France might recognize it as Cassis, as it might have been before World War II, a simple fishing village.
About the author. Rhys Bowen is the New York Times best-selling author of more than 60 novels, including The Rose Arbor, The Paris Assignment, Where the Sky Begins,
the Venice Sketchbook, Above the Bay of Angels, The Victory Garden, The Tuscan Child, and In Farley Field. The winner of the Lefty Award for Best Historical Mystery Novel and the Agatha Award for Best Historical Novel. She is also the author of The Royal's Finest Mysteries and several other series. Bowen's work has been translated into many languages and has won 16 honors to date, including multiple Agatha, Anthony, and McCavity Awards. A transplanted Brit, Bowen divides her time between California and Arizona. For more information, visit www.reesbowen.com. That's www.reesbowen.com. This concludes Mrs. Endicott's Splendid Adventure. Thanks so much for listening.
Hi, this is Sue reading a short story from William Trevor's Selected Stories. William Trevor was born in Ireland in County Cork and spent his childhood in provincial Ireland. He studied at Trinity College in Dublin. He's written 14 novels and 13 collections of short stories and has won many prizes. This story is Child's Play. Gerard and Rebecca became brother and sister after a turmoil of distress. Each had witnessed it from a different point of view. Gerard in one house, Rebecca in another. 2 years of passionate quarreling, arguing and agreeing, of beginning again, of failure and reconciliation, of final insults and rejection constituted the peep show they viewed. There were no other children of the two wrecked marriages. And when the final period of acrimonious wrangling came to an end, there was an unexpected accord as to the division of the families. This, it was decided, would be more satisfactorily decreed by the principals involved than by the divorce courts. Gerard's father, innocent in what had occurred, agreed that Gerard should live with his mother since that was convenient. Rebecca's mother, innocent also, declared herself unfit to raise the child of a marriage she had come to loathe, and declared as well that she could not bring herself to go on living in the house of the marriage. She claimed that suicidal tendencies had developed in her. Aggravated by the familiar surroundings, she would suffer the loss of her child for her child's sake. She's trying all this on, the other woman insisted, but in the end it appeared she wasn't, and so the arrangement was made. On a warm Wednesday afternoon, the day Quest for Fame won the Derby, Gerard's mother married Rebecca's father. Afterwards, all four of them stood, eyes tightened against strong sunlight, while someone took a photograph. The two children were of an age, Gerard 10, Rebecca 9. Gerard was dark-haired, quite noticeably thin, with glasses. Rebecca's reddish hair curved roundly about her rounded cheeks. Her eyes were bright, a deep shade of blue. Gerard's brown were solemn. They were neutrally disposed to one another, with neither fondness nor distaste on either side. They did not know one another well. Gerard was an intruder in the house that had been Rebecca's, but this was far less to bear than the departure from it of her mother. "They'll settle," Rebecca's father murmured in a tea shop after the wedding. Watching the two children silent beside one another, his new wife said she hoped so. They did settle. Thrown together as helpless parties in the stipulations of the peace, they became companions. They missed the past. Resentment and deprivation drew them close. They talked about the two people whom they visited on Sundays and how those two, once at the center of things, were now defeated and displaced. At the top of the house, attic space had been reclaimed to form a single low-roofed room with windows to the ground and a new parquet floor that seemed to stretch forever. The walls were a shade of washed-out primrose, and shafts of sunlight made the pale ash of the parquet seem almost white. There was no furniture. Two bare electric light bulbs hung from the long, slanted ceiling. This no-man's land was where Gerard and Rebecca played their game of marriage and divorce. It became a secret game, words fading on their lips if someone entered, politeness disguising their deceit. Rebecca recalled her mother weeping at lunch, a sudden collapse into ugly distress, while she was spooning peas onto Rebecca's plate. "Whatever's up?" Rebecca asked, watching as her mother hurried from the table. Her father did not answer, but instead left the dining room himself, and a few moments later there were the sounds of a quarrel. "You've made me hate you," Rebecca's mother kept screaming so shrilly that Rebecca thought that people in the house next door would hear. "How could you have made me hate you?" Gerard entered a room and found his mother nursing the side of her face. His father stood at the window looking out. Behind his back, one hand gripped the other as if in restraint. Gerard was frightened and went away, his brief presence unnoticed. "Think of that child," Rebecca's mother pleaded in another mood. "Stay with us, if only for that child." "You vicious witch," this furious accusation stuttered out of Gerard's father, his voice peculiar, his lips trembling in a grimace he could not control. Such scenes, seemingly like the end of everything that mattered, were later surveyed from the unemotional safety of the new companionship. Regret was exorcised, sore places healed, harshness was the savior. From information supplied by television, a world of sin and romance was put together in the empty attic room. "Think of that child," Rebecca mimicked, and Gerard adopted his father's grimace the time he called his mother a vicious witch. It was fun because the erring couple were so virtuous now. "I can't think how it happened." Gerard's version of the guilty husband's voice was not convincing, but it passed whatever muster was required. "I can't think how I could have been such a fool as to marry her in the first place. Poor thing, it's not her fault. It's that makes it such an awful guilt." This came from an old black-and-white film and was used a lot because they liked the sound of it. When romance was to the fore, they spoke in whispers, making a murmuring sound when they didn't know what to say. They tried out dance steps in the attic, pretending they were in a dance hall they called the Ruby Ballroom or a nightclub they called the Nightlight, a title they'd seen in neon somewhere. They called a bar the Bee's Knees, which Rebecca said was a name suitable for a bar, although the original was a stocking shop. They called a hotel the Grand Splendide, some sleazy hotel, Gerard's father had scornfully put it, some sleazy pay-at-the-door hotel for his sleazy one-night stands. "No, actually," the reply had been, "it was rather grand." Downstairs, they watched a television serial in which the wronged ones made the kind of fuss that both Gerard and Rebecca had witnessed. The erring ones met in car parks or on wasteland in the early morning. "Gosh," Rebecca exclaimed, softly astonished at what was occurring on the screen. "He took his tongue out of her mouth, definitely. She's chewing his lips, actually, but his tongue, I know. Horrid great thing it looked. Look, you be Mrs. Edwina, Rebecca." They turned the television off and climbed to the top of the house, not saying anything on the way. They closed the door behind them. "Okay," Rebecca said, "I'm Mrs. Edwina." Gerard made his bell ringing sound. "Oh, go away." Staring intently into space, Rebecca went on doing so until the sound occurred again. She sighed and rose from where she'd been sitting on the floor. Grumbling wordlessly, she ran on the spot, descending stairs. "Yes, what is it, please? Mrs. Edwina. Sure, I'm Mrs. Edwina. I saw your card in the window of that news agent's. What's it called? The Good News, is it? What do you want, please? It says you have a room to let." "What of it? I was watching Dallas." "I'm sorry, Mrs. Edwina. Do you want to rent a room? I have a use for a room, yes. You'd best come in. Cold evening, Mrs. Edwina. I hope you're not planning a love nest. I don't want no filth in my house. Oh, what a lovely little room. If it's for a love nest, it'll be £10 more per week. Another 10 on top of that if you're into call girls. I can assure you, Mrs. Edwina. You read some terrible tales in the papers these days. Beauty Queen, a call girl, it said the other day. Are you fixing to bring in beauty queens? No, no, nothing like that. A friend and myself have been going to the Grand Splendide, but it's not the same. You'd be a married man? Yes, I get the picture. Rebecca's mother had demanded to know where the sinning had taken place. Gerard's mother, questioned similarly, had revealed that the forbidden meetings had taken place in different locations, once or twice in her lover's office, after hours, over lunch or 5:30 drinks. A hotel was mentioned, and finally a hired room. How sordid! Rebecca's mother cried, then weeping overcame her, and Rebecca crept away. But elsewhere, Gerard remained. He reported that extraordinary exchanges had followed, that great importance was attached to the room that had been specially acquired, great offense taken. "I'm tired of this ghastly hole." Rebecca was good at introducing a whine into her tone, a bad-tempered, spoilt child sound that years ago she'd once or twice tried on in reality before being sharply told to cease immediately. "Oh, it's not too bad, darling. It's most unpleasant. It's dirty for a start. Look at the sheets. I've never seen sheets as soiled as that. Then Mrs. Edwina is dirty. You can see it on her neck. Filthy dirty, that woman is. Oh, she's not too bad. There's a smell of meat in the hall. She never opens a window. Darling, I want to live in a house. I want us to be divorced and married again. I know, but there are the children, and there's the awful guilt I feel. What I feel is sick in my bowels. Every time I walk in that door, I feel it. Every time I look at that filthy wallpaper, I get vomit in my throat. We could paint the place out. Let's go to the Bee's Knees for a cocktail. Let's never come back here. But, Angel, our love's not like it used to be. It's not like it was when we went dancing in the Ruby Ballroom. We haven't been to the Nightlight for a year, nor the Grand Splendide. You wanted a home from home. I don't think you love me anymore. Of course I do. Then tell Mrs. Edwina what she can do with her horrid old room and let's live in a house. But, dear, the children. Drown the brats in a bucket. Make a present of them to Mrs. Edwina for all I can care. Cement them into a wall. We'll just get into bed for 5 minutes. I don't want to get into bed today, not the way those sheets are. Okay, we'll go and have a baby jam. I love a baby jam. When the house was empty except for themselves, it was best. It often was empty in the early afternoon, after the woman who came to clean had gone, when Gerard's mother was out doing the voluntary work she had recently taken up. They wandered from room to room then, poking into everything. Among other items of interest, they found letters, some written by Gerard's mother to Rebecca's father, some by him to her. They were in a dressing table drawer in a slim cardboard box with a rubber band around them. Twice the love affair had broken up. Twice there were farewells. Twice the admission that one could not live without the other. They could not help themselves. They had to meet again. My, my, Rebecca enthused. Hot stuff, this. After their weekend visits to the two who had been wrong, Gerard and Rebecca exchanged reports on Sunday evenings. Gerard's father cooked and used the washing machine, vacuum cleaned the house, ironed his own shirts, made his bed, and weeded the flower beds. Rebecca's mother was in a bed sitting room, a sorry sight. She ate nuts and chocolate while watching the television, saying it wasn't worth cooking for one, not that she minded in the least. She was keeping her end up, Rebecca's mother insisted. "You can see," she confided. "Why, I didn't think I should look after you, dear. It wasn't because I didn't want you. You're all that's left to me. You're what I live for, darling." Rebecca saw perfectly. The bed-sitting room was uncomfortable. In one corner, the bedclothes of a divan, pulled roughly up in daytime, were lumpy beneath a stained pink bedspread. Possessions Rebecca remembered, though had not known were particularly her mother's, ornaments and a tea set. Two pictures of medieval people on horses, a table lamp, chairs and floor rugs, and inappropriately, a gong, cluttered the limited space. Her mother's lipstick was carelessly applied. The same clothes she'd worn in the past, smart then, seemed like cast-offs now. She refused to take a penny of alimony, insisting that part of keeping her end up was to stand on her own two feet. She'd found a job in a theater cafe and talked a lot about the actors and actresses who bought cups of coffee or tea from her. All this theatrical talk was boring, Rebecca reported on Sunday evenings. Her mother had never been boring before. Gerard's father, hurrying through his household chores so that he could devote himself to entertaining Gerard, was not the same either. He was more serious. He didn't spread himself about in the sitting room the way he used to, his legs stretched awkwardly out so that people fell over them. Another boy had once shown Gerard how to untie his father's shoelaces and tie them together while his attention was diverted. His father had never minded being laughed at. Gerard wasn't so sure about that now. "She said she had 3 miscarriages," Rebecca reported. "I never knew that." Gerard wasn't certain what a miscarriage was, and Rebecca, who had been uncertain also, explained that the baby came out too soon, a lot of mush, apparently. "I wonder if I'm adopted," Gerard mused. The next weekend he asked his father and was assured he wasn't. His father said his mother hadn't wanted more than a single child, but from his tone, Gerard decided that she hadn't wanted any children at all. "I'm a mistake," he said, when he and Rebecca were alone again. Rebecca agreed that this was probably so. She supposed she should be glad she wasn't just a lot of mush. "You be the detective," she said. Gerard rapped with his knuckles on the parquet floor, and Rebecca opened and closed the door. "What do you want?" "Hotel detective lady." "So what?" "I'll tell you so what. So what is I have grounds for believing you and your companion are not Mr. and Mrs. Smith as per the entry in the register." "Of course we're Mr. and Mrs. Smith." "I would appreciate a word with Mr. Smith, ma'am." "Mr. Smith's in the lavatory." "Do you categorically state that you are named Mrs. Smith, ma'am? Do you categorically state that you and the party in the lavatory are man and wife?" "Definitely." "Do you categorically state you're not in the prostitution business?" "The very idea." "Then what we have here is a case of mistaken identity. Accept my apologies, ma'am. We get all sorts in the grand splendide these days." "No offense taken, officer. The public has a right to be protected." "Time was when only royalty stayed at the Grand Splendide. I knew the King of Greece, you know." "Fancy that. Generous to a fault, he was." "Oh, thank you very much, lady." "Fancy a cocktail, officer? Baby Cham on the rocks, okay?" "Certainly is. Oh, and ma'am, how can I help you, officer?" "Feel free to ply your trade, ma'am." A little brother, Gerard's mother informed them, or perhaps a sister. Gerard didn't ask if this was another mistake because he could tell from the delight in his mother's eyes that it wasn't. There might even be further babies, Rebecca speculated when they were alone. She didn't care for the idea of other children in the house. They'll be the real thing, she said. Something else happened. Gerard returned after a weekend to say there'd been a black-haired French woman in his father's house. She strolled about the kitchen in stockinged feet and did the cooking. One result of this person's advent was to cause Gerard to feel less sympathetically disposed towards his father. He felt his father would be all right now, as his mother and Rebecca's father were all right. "That'll be nice for you," Rebecca's mother remarked sourly when Rebecca passed on the information about the expected baby. "Nice for you and Gerard." When Rebecca told her about the French woman, she said that that was nice, too. These were the only comments she made, Rebecca told Gerard afterwards. Keeping her end up, her mother engaged in a tedious rigmarole about some famous actor or other whom Rebecca had never heard of. She also kept saying the rigmarole was funny, a view Rebecca didn't share. Let's do the time she caught them, Rebecca suggested when she'd gone through the rigmarole for Gerard. Okay. Gerard lay down on the parquet and Rebecca went out of the room. Gerard worked his lips in an imaginary embrace. His tongue lolled out. This is disgusting, Rebecca cried, bursting into the room again. Gerard sat up. He asked her what she was doing here. A cleaner let me in. She said I'd find you on the office floor. You'd better go, Gerard muttered quietly to his pretend companion, pushing himself to his feet. I've known for ages. Real tears spread on Rebecca's rounded cheeks. Quite a gush, she managed. She'd always been good at real tears. I'm sorry. Sorry, my God. I know. She forgot her panties. She left her panties by the waste paper basket when she scurried out. Look. She's on the street without her panties, some man on the tube. Look, don't be bitter. Why not? Why shouldn't I be whatever I want to be? Isn't anything my due? You were down on the floor with a second-class tart, and you expect me to be like the Virgin Mary? I do not expect you to be like anyone. You want me to share you with her? Is that it? What a jolliness. Look. Oh, don't keep saying look. Rebecca's real tears came in a torrent now, dribbling onto a gray cardigan, reddening her eyes. I'd better go after her, Gerard said, picking up, in pantomime, a garment from the floor. The baby was born, a girl. The black-haired French woman moved in with Gerard's father. One Sunday evening, Rebecca said, she wants me back. That day had been spent trailing round flats that were to rent. Each time they entered one, Rebecca's mother told whoever was showing them around that she worked in the theater and mentioned actresses and actors by name. Afterwards, in the bed sitting room, she said her new life in the theater had helped her to pull herself together. She said she felt a strength returning. She intended to take the alimony. She saw it differently now. The alimony was her due. So are you, dear, she said. If there was difficulty, a court of law would put the matter right. No doubt about that. A child goes to the mother if the mother's fit and well. What did you say? Gerard asked. Nothing. Not that you'd rather be here? No. Would you rather be here, Rebecca? Yes. Gerard was silent. He looked away. I couldn't say it, Rebecca said. I see you couldn't. She's my mother, Rebecca said. Yes, I know. A week ago, they had been angry together because unhappiness had made her mother foolish. A week ago, Gerard said his father had reverted to something like his old self. His legs stuck out while he read the newspaper. But it was far from being the same as it had been. His father reading the newspaper like that was only a reminder. Rebecca's real tears began, and when the sound of sobbing ceased, there was silence in the room they had made their own. Gerard wanted to comfort her as once his father had comforted his mother, saying he forgave her, saying they would try again. But their game wouldn't stretch to that. They sat on the virgin floor some distance away from one another while the white shafts of sunlight faded and the washed-out yellow of the walls dimmed to nothing. Their thoughts were similar, and they knew they were. The house that had been Rebecca's would be Gerard's because that was laid down now. Rebecca would come to it at weekends because her father was there. But she would not bring with her her mother's sad tales of the theater, nor would Gerard relate the latest from his father's new relationship. The easy companionship that allowed them to sip cocktails and sign the register of the Hotel Grand Splendide had been theirs by chance, a gift thrown out from other people's circumstances. Helplessness was their natural state. And that was the story by William Trevor entitled Child's Play. I hope you enjoyed it.